This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
And I'm Flora Lichtman. Later in the hour, separating fact from fiction when it comes to health risks of vaping. How does it compare to smoking? And what does the science say about the efficacy of e-cigarettes to help people kick their cigarette habit? But first, over the past week, the Trump administration has ordered changes at our biggest federal science agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health. The news is coming fast and furious, and it can feel hard to keep up. Our next guest is here to help. Anil Oza is a reporter for STAT and MIT based in Boston, Massachusetts. Anil has been keeping close tabs on what's happening at the agencies and is here to explain. Anil, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Flora. Good to be here.
Okay, so late last week, we started getting news that data on the CDC's website was disappearing. First of all, what disappeared?
Yeah, that's right. So late last week on Friday, we were seeing the CDC scrub a lot of the data sets from their website. And so normally anyone can go to the CDC's website and download data sets for a whole slew of different health issues. But to sort of comply with some of Trump's executive orders, by 5 p.m. on Friday, they were trying to scrub a lot of these data sets to comply with two of these executive orders that Trump put in place. One, to sort of remove DEI, and so that would remove mentions of race and ethnicity. And another, to sort of deal with, I believe, what he calls gender ideology, and so that would remove mentions of sexual orientation, of gender identity. And so one of the data sets was the Youth Behavior Survey, which measures gender and sexual orientation in teenagers. And a lot of data sets, even if they're not sort of expressly about racial inequities, they include data about people's race. And so a lot of these would run sort of afoul of this executive order.
I also saw that there were data sets about things like HIV and sexual health and tuberculosis, and reported just yesterday bird flu. What are the consequences of this information disappearing?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be hard to see the sort of short-term impacts of this. But I mean, in the long term, these data are sort of about understanding where the need is the greatest in the U.S. for these different diseases like bird flu or like tuberculosis or other STIs and things like that. And so if you see these data be offline for a long time and future data not collected, it would be much harder to sort of know where we need to dedicate resources and time and attention throughout the country. And I mean, I think it's particularly shocking because normally the sort of U.S. federal agencies are the sort of gold standard data, the sort of envy of the entire world, which is why I think the fact that they were being tampered with, taken down, was such a shock to researchers and journalists.
I think I read some of the data sets have reappeared. Have you seen that?
Yeah, that's right. So sort of since the outcry about these data sets being removed, some of them have been put up. And even sort of journalists and researchers, when they heard that these data sets were about to be taken down, there was sort of a mad dash to sort of download these data sets and to sort of archive them so that they were there in case they weren't put back up online. But I think this raises an issue, obviously, about the sort of veracity of the data, that if they were taken down, they may have been tampered with. And so I know that some of these researchers that downloaded the data are now sort of cross-comparing their archival data with what's been put up to see what, if anything, has changed.
This week, the CDC also ordered withdrawals of certain new scientific papers from its researchers. Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, that's right. So also late last week on Friday, the CDC ordered its researchers to sort of withdraw its papers. So these are papers that have not sort of been made public, but are going through the scientific review process that have some of these terms that we've been talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, or about gender. The CDC was asking scientists to sort of withdraw papers that they had collaborated on with these terms included in them. But it may seem like a small issue, but often, you know, any paper that mentions health and wellness will include these data just as a matter of knowing what the sort of makeup of the patient population is. And I mean, this must be incredibly frustrating both to the scientists at the CDC and the NIH, but also the researchers that collaborated with them, because notoriously, scientific publishing is a very slow-moving process. And so it's very possible that there are papers that have been in the works for months, if not years, that may have to sort of get pulled at the finish line here.
Let's shift gears to the National Institutes of Health. There's been some ups and downs there in the last few weeks with, you know, a communication ban and grant-making operations paused. What's been happening and what's going on now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the really shocking things that rattled the scientific community when Trump first took office was this communication ban from the federal agencies. It meant that researchers at these federal institutions couldn't collaborate with people that they've collaborated with for years. But one of the things that was really shocking and abrupt was they canceled study sections at the NIH, which is these groups that are formed to review grants for applications to sort of fund research. And so these groups of professors and researchers will meet and sort of determine whether or not research is worth funding. And they completely just stop those kind of on a dime. And so my colleague Megan Multeni and I this week reported that some of them are restarting. The first study section to meet in over 3 weeks was on Tuesday, which initially seemed like a good sign. But I think there are still concerns about whether or not the Trump administration is sort of tampering with these processes. So not all study sections have been restarted. Some researchers have said that some have been rescheduled, and other sort of advisory meetings for the NIH have been paused to sort of comply with some of Trump's other executive orders. So things are not sort of completely as normal at the NIH, but they are slowly starting to come back online.
Anil, thanks for your reporting on this.
Of course, it was a pleasure to be here.
Anil Oza is a reporter for STAT and MIT based in Boston. Next up, we are leaving the Beltway for a look at other science news of the week. As you know, we have been tracking the bird flu situation closely here at Science Friday. This week, we got news that dairy cows in Nevada have been infected with a different version of H5N1 bird flu, a form that may put people who work closely with cows at higher risk. Here to give us an update on this and other science stories from the week is Kathleen Davis, SciFri producer based in New York. Welcome, Kathleen.
Hi, Flora.
Okay, what do we know about this form of bird flu?
So on Wednesday, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced that, as you said, a new form of the bird flu virus was found in Nevada dairy cows. This is still H5N1 bird flu, but a different form, and this is called D1.1. And this is actually the predominant form of bird flu that is found in migrating birds. But the thing with this form is that it wasn't previously known to be able to spread to cows. So the infection that we have seen in dairy cows up until now was another form of bird flu called B3.13.
I mean, we know dozens of dairy workers have been infected with B3.13, and they've had relatively mild symptoms. Have any people been infected with this form, D1.1?
Yes, and that is a big part of the concern. So we know that this form of bird flu has killed one person. That was a Louisiana resident over 65 years old. This person died back in January. Also, a 13-year-old Canadian girl was infected by this virus back in November. She had a pre-existing condition and was on life support, but she did recover. So there are new concerns for dairy workers and people who work with cows. And the more that this virus moves around and replicates, the more chances there are for mutations that might make it easier for it to spread to and among humans.
How's the government responding to this development?
Yeah, so the USDA is testing milk for the bird flu virus. This is how this strain was detected in the first place. This testing is done before milk is pasteurized. So we know that the virus can be present in unpasteurized raw milk. But if you're worried about whether or not drinking milk is safe, if you're drinking good old pasteurized milk, which is what most of us do drink, this heats the milk for a short amount of time and that virus is inactivated. So you shouldn't have anything to worry about.
Let's move on to some good news about AI detecting breast cancer. Tell me about this.
So AI is everywhere now, obviously. But one of the things that years ago scientists were talking about and were really excited about were the prospects of AI in the medical field. So this is doing things like detecting cancer in x-rays. The idea here is, for example, you can feed an AI model a ton of images of what breast cancer looks like in a mammogram. The AI then knows what breast cancer looks like, and in theory, it can pick out cancer more accurately than a person could. It's also a lot faster than what one radiologist can do. So now this has been put into practice. We recently got the results of the largest randomized trial for this. More than 100,000 women were part of this study where, in some cases, AI took a look at mammograms and in other cases, a human radiologist did. And the group that used AI had a 29% higher detection of cancer with no false positives.
The AI beat the doctors.
It did.
That's amazing.
It is. And a lot of experts are looking at the future of this as like AI and radiologists work together to detect breast cancer. And you know, for breast cancer in particular, this can be huge. Women here in the U.S. have a 13% average risk of getting breast cancer sometime in their life. And so better early detection really could be a lifesaver.
You've got one more story for us featuring a charismatic megafossil, one of our favorites, Lucy.
Yes, Lucy is one of the most famous fossils. She was a human ancestor, an Australopithecus afarensis. She lived about 3.2 million years ago. And we do know a lot about Lucy because her skeleton is pretty complete. We have about 40% of it. And now researchers have put her on a virtual treadmill to answer the age-old question, how the heck would Lucy run?
And how would she run?
Well, these researchers reconstructed what they think her leg and pelvic muscles would look like. Obviously, those aren't present in the fossils that we do have of Lucy, but they did their best estimate. And they found that Lucy standing upright was about 3.5 feet tall. She weighed somewhere between 29 and 93 pounds, which is obviously a huge spread. And she was capable of standing and walking upright. So Lucy does have more ape-like characteristics than we do. Her upper body is proportionately larger than ours, for example. She's got longer arms and shorter legs. So if she did have to run, it was probably just for short bursts. The generous explanation from the researchers is that Lucy was not a natural runner.
They always do these reconstructions. Did they reconstruct her running style, and what did it look like?
Oh, they sure did. I mean, running's a pretty generous term. She's kind of got both legs at like 90 degree angles. She's got this forward lean. They say that she had a max speed of 11 miles per hour. She doesn't have that springy running gait that modern humans have. So, I mean, no offense to Lucy, but I think you and I, Flora, could really beat her pretty easily on the track if we wanted to.
Speak for yourself, Kathleen. When you were describing max speed of 11 miles per hour, I was like, that's me. That's my running style.
It's all relative, Flora.
That's all the time we have. Kathleen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kathleen Davis, Sci-Fry producer based in New York. We have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll dig through the scientific research on vaping. How bad is it for your health? And why do researchers disagree about whether e-cigarettes should be used to help people quit smoking?
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The harms of smoking cigarettes are pretty clear. It's the leading cause of preventable death in the United States. It causes cancer, heart disease, lung disease. But when it comes to vaping or e-cigarettes, the risks are a bit more tricky to figure out. And the outbreak of e-cigarette or vaping use associated lung injury, EVALI, in 2019 and 2020 made things even more confusing. The founders of Juul, the company that popularized vaping, said they wanted to help people kick their smoking habits. But can vapes really help people quit? And how bad are they for you, really? And if you're addicted to vaping, how can you kick the habit? Joining me now to answer those questions and more is one of the top researchers in the field, Dr. Jamie Hartman-Boyce, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Management, University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you. Let's jump right in now. When most people think about the harms of vaping, they're probably thinking of EVALI or the outbreak a few years ago. Thousands of young people ended up in the hospital, as we all know. Can you give us a refresher on what was causing that illness?
Absolutely. So one of the scary things about that illness is when it first started, no one really knew what was causing it, other than that it was following the use of e-cigarettes or following vaping. Over time, after a lot of investigation, it was linked back to an additive in some e-liquids called vitamin E acetate. That is something that we absolutely know should never be inhaled, but it was put in e-cigarette cartridges to make them look like they contained more THC than they actually did. And that was what was causing all of that illness.
Is that gone now?
That is gone now for the most part. We know that it makes people sick, but to be fair, we knew that it would make people sick before EVALI started as well. So what we have now are more careful checks on e-liquids, particularly if they're sold in states where marijuana is legal and people are buying them from dispensaries. But there's still always a risk if you're getting an e-cigarette from a source like your neighbor's garage, that it could have something in it that would make you really sick.
Yeah, I certainly see why. Let's say, though, that you're buying licensed vapes that don't contain vitamin E acetate. What are the health risks here?
It's a great question, and there's a number of complexities around it which make it hard to give one clear answer. When it comes to a nicotine-containing e-cigarette that is authorized for marketing and sale by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, those products have been really extensively tested, and they've found, though not to be risk-free, to be substantially less harmful than something like smoking. However, vaping hasn't been around for all of that long. So in terms of the research on what's going to happen when people have vaped for decades, we're still waiting to see. And also, it's going to vary a lot based on the type of device you're using and based on what you're vaping. As we saw in Evoli, what goes into your e-cigarette has a huge impact on whether or not it's going to harm your health.
Mm-hmm, because the vape still contains nicotine, right?
That's right. So nicotine has a very bad name for good reason. It's the thing that's been getting people addicted to smoking for hundreds and hundreds of years. But nicotine in and of itself is not the thing that causes the cancer, the respiratory problems, the heart disease that we associate with smoking. Those are caused by the burning of the tobacco in a cigarette. And the nicotine is what keeps us coming back for more. So nicotine in and of itself, in reasonable doses, like you might get in a patch or a gum, has been proven to be pretty safe.
Is there different data for people who vape cannabis versus who vape tobacco?
It is such an important issue and one that I think the scientific literature has not done a good job on. Often the surveys that get asked and the studies that screen people in ask if people vape, but they don't ask them what they're vaping. And that's really essential because we know what you're vaping is going to affect the health risks that come with it. The other thing that plays into this is that sometimes people who vape don't know what they're vaping, and we need more awareness around that too.
We've all read about the alarming number of teens who are vaping. Are they, because of their age, more at risk?
Yeah, they are more at risk. I mean, first of all, teens in general might be more likely to use products that are not regulated, and they might be coming from sources where they're not kind of as established in their testing in terms of what's in there. We also know that, of course, the adolescent brain is very different from the adult brain. And so one of the real concerns about teen vaping when it comes to nicotine is that it's establishing a new addiction to nicotine. And we know that addictions in general are things that can cause a lot of harm to us. They can cost a lot of money. They can disrupt our lives.
Is it possible to compare the risk of smoking traditional cigarettes to e-cigarettes?
Absolutely possible to compare, and many people have done that. So the evidence is really clear that if you're comparing smoking to a licensed nicotine-containing e-cigarette, the e-cigarette is going to bring much, much less risk to you. E-cigarettes do not contain many of the toxic substances that are contained in cigarettes. And they also, when you vape, you're not burning anything. And we know that a lot of the harm that comes from smoking is coming from the burning. E-cigarettes were originally invented as a way to try and reduce the harm from inhaling nicotine.
But to be clear on this, based on the research, can we definitely say that vaping is less harmful than cigarettes?
We can. It depends what you're vaping, of course, right? So if you're vaping something with vitamin E acetate, no. If you're vaping a licensed nicotine-containing e-cigarette, yes, we can say that. There are dozens of randomized controlled trials, which are really high-quality ways to test the effects of an intervention. And those show that people who switch from smoking to exclusively vaping reduce their health risks.
You know, I think that's something that really gets lost in the conversation around vaping, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Now, why do you think that is?
I think there are a whole host of things that play into that. One of them is, of course, that there is very genuine concern that any positive or reassuring messaging around vaping in people who smoke could make it more likely that people who don't smoke, and particularly young people, might take up vaping. So that's a real concern that comes into play. We've also, for decades and decades, and are still in a position in the U.S. where the majority of people, including the majority of physicians, think that nicotine is the harmful substance in cigarettes. And that means that if people are vaping nicotine, we assume that they're also going to be equally as harmful.
Let's talk about that just in a little bit more of detail, because I noticed when you're vaping, you're also heating up the substance too, right? Why is that different than burning it like smoking?
Absolutely. So in smoking, you are essentially creating fire, right? You're lighting it with a match or a lighter, and combustion is happening, that chemical process that releases all sorts of nasty things. When you're vaping, you're not burning anything. You're heating up a liquid, which is turning into a vapor. But that's a very different process chemically than what happens if you're actually burning tobacco leaf.
Let's get down now to the big question here, and that is, how useful are e-cigarettes as a smoking cessation tool as compared to, let's say, other methods?
So it's a great question. The studies of nicotine e-cigarettes for smoking cessation are generally very promising. They show, on average, that nicotine e-cigarettes help more people quit smoking than nicotine replacement therapies like patches or gums or lozenges. There have been fewer studies that compare nicotine e-cigarettes to some of the medications that can be used for smoking cessation. There's a drug called varenicline, which is one of the best available ways to help people quit smoking. The evidence we have can't really differentiate between the two in terms of effectiveness, but we hope more studies will give us some clearer answers on that.
You know, there's always this aura about taking a puff, inhaling a cigarette, you know. Is there something about the action of inhaling a vape, mimicking the pleasure of a cigarette, that is uniquely helpful to aid people to quit smoking?
That's a great question. It depends on the person, but we absolutely know for a lot of people, those kind of behavioral, psychological, social cues that we associate with smoking, whether it be the visual image of the smoke coming out of your mouth, something that's called a throat hit, which is that feeling when it hits the back of your throat, or just an excuse to step outside during work, or if you're out with friends, to go into a smoking area. All of those really reinforce addiction to smoking. And when nicotine e-cigarettes first came out, scientists in the smoking cessation area were excited because all of a sudden there was something that could mimic a lot of those behaviors, the sociology and psychology of smoking, without causing as much harm.
There's some research suggesting that many smokers who are trying to quit will smoke regular cigarettes and also vape. How should we understand this data?
So that's a phenomenon called dual use. People are both smoking and they're vaping as well. And there are different takes on this. There's absolutely justifiable concern that people could be increasing their risk by doing that. But there's also data that shows that if you give people who smoke an e-cigarette with the instruction that they're using it to reduce or help them quit smoking entirely, even if they end up smoking some, they end up smoking less than they were at the start. And we see reduced markers of risk in those people. There are also people who essentially find that they need to dual use for a long time before they can switch completely to vaping.
Oh, so it's still like it's like a bridge then.
Exactly. It can be a bridge out.
Yeah. Now, as we discussed, the science seems to back e-cigarettes as an effective tool to help people quit smoking. But there is still quite a bit of disagreement about this among researchers, isn't there?
There is. It remains a contentious topic. When you kind of dig into it, a lot of that disagreement isn't about the question of whether or not nicotine e-cigarettes help people quit smoking. We have good evidence that they do. The concerns are more about if they're available to help people quit smoking, what's going to happen if people who don't smoke, particularly kids, start using them? Also, what are the longer term harms of vaping? And also, do you think the concern about smoking is ultimately the health harms from smoking or the addiction to nicotine? And if what you're concerned about is the addiction to nicotine, switching to a nicotine e-cigarette is not going to get rid of that.
Yeah, I think there's also a little bit of distrust, perhaps, of the tobacco industry.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which has now gotten into e-cigarettes.
Absolutely. So when e-cigarettes first came out and kind of we first became aware of them and they were being commercially marketed, they weren't being manufactured by the tobacco industry. But the tobacco industry has taken over a lot of our major e-cigarette brands, has a big share of the market. And that is an understandable and justifiable concern. You know, there are decades of history here.
Yeah. But you still come down on the public health side of this, that the benefit is clear to vaping.
Where I come down on it always is that I'm driven by the evidence, right? So I look at what the evidence shows and make my decisions based on that. And I think the evidence is really clear that for people who smoke, switching to e-cigarettes can help them quit smoking completely and improve their chances of living a longer, happier, healthier life.
Mm-hmm. Would you go as far as to say that we should recommend people use e-cigarettes to help them quit?
I think the language that a lot of people use, which I quite like, is individualistic to the person in front of them. So if you are someone who smokes, who wants to quit, and you've never tried, for example, nicotine patches or gums or varenicline, you have access to those things. We have a lot more research and a lot more safety data on those. So trying those first is probably a good idea. If, however, you're someone who smokes and you've used those before, they haven't worked, or you have no interest in using them or can't access them, then thinking about going and trying a licensed nicotine-containing e-cigarette is certainly something the evidence would support.
Well, then would it be good health policy to prevent teens from picking up vaping, or would that be better than them picking up cigarettes? I mean, how do you balance the risk and the benefits here?
That is something that is heavily debated in the circles that I'm part of. So ideally, we don't want young people using any form of nicotine. We don't want them vaping. We don't want them smoking. And my take on it, based on the evidence, based on the fact that we know the really enormous health harms that come from smoking, is that we certainly shouldn't discourage vaping more than we discourage smoking. We want to be really clear that smoking is incredibly harmful. If you don't smoke, you also shouldn't vape. And I think policies that confuse that issue can confuse the public. And there's some evidence to suggest that sometimes that can result in maybe more youth smoking than we'd see otherwise. And anything that increases youth smoking is a public health loss.
Yeah. Now, I know a lot of people have talked about how hard it is to quit vaping. And I understand that this has been a focus of your research lately. What have you found? What's most effective?
That's right. So this is a really new area of research. And we set out recently to review everything that had been published so far on the ways to help people quit vaping. There's not that much to say right now. We don't have that many studies that are completed. Those that are fairly small. There are loads of studies in the pipeline. So all of a sudden, as a research area, this has really exploded. But what the evidence does show us so far are that the interventions with the most promise are a text message-based intervention in young people. That absolutely showed an increase in people successfully quitting vaping. We don't know if the same would happen with other text message-based interventions or in older people. So kind of jury's still out in some of those other areas. And there was also some promising evidence for the medication varenicline, which is available on prescription as a stop smoking medication. And in an early trial, results were promising for vaping cessation as well.
Let me wrap up by asking you what you think is the biggest misconception about vaping.
I think the biggest misconception is that it is as or more dangerous than smoking. So I started working in vaping research back in 2014. And every year we find more and more studies that show that nicotine vaping still carries risks, but is much less risky than smoking. At the same time, public perceptions go the opposite way. So over time, more and more people believe that vaping is as risky or riskier than smoking. And that's a really big problem if you're someone who smokes.
Right. Well, let me give you the blank check question I give a lot of my researchers because they don't ever have enough money. If you had all the money in the world, what are the questions in the data that you would like to answer that we still don't have answers to that might be helped by this blank check?
Yeah. Oh, what a nice thought. So what I think we really need to do is, this sounds kind of boring, but from a science perspective, it's essential, get a better way of recording people's vaping behavior in their electronic medical records. And the reason for this is that that's where we got really good data on the harms of smoking. It was being routinely recorded, and then people were being followed up, and we could say 30 years later, someone who smoked in the 1950s was much more likely to have lung cancer in the 1980s. We need that data, and we particularly need to know it for people who don't smoke and just vape, so we can really get a better sense of what the harms might be from vaping.
Thank you very much for what you do and for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Jamie Hartman-Boyce, Assistant Professor of Health Policy and Management at the University of Massachusetts. That's in Amherst, Mass. And we want to hear from you. Have you tried to quit vaping? What methods did you try? What's been the hardest part for you? Tell us. Call us at 646-767-6532. That number again, 646-767-6532, or send us a voice memo. Yeah, a voice memo, a file to scifry@sciencefriday.com. scifry@sciencefriday.com. We have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn some lessons about fire management from one tribe in Northern California.
This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. And now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
KQED Iowa News. Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. The Karuk tribe in Northern California has a long history with fire. For millennia, the tribe has managed its land and protected communities from wildfire, in part by using controlled burns. Now the tribe is working with federal agencies and local nonprofits to lead trainings on prescribed burns. Our next guest reported on a recent burn and is here to tell us all about it. Murphy Woodhouse is a reporter for Boise State Public Radio and the Mountain West News Bureau based in Boise, Idaho. Murphy, welcome to Science Friday.
Really glad to be here.
Okay, so for your reporting, you watched a prescribed fire on Karuk tribal land. What should I picture?
Yeah, so last fall, I went to Northern California, to the small town of Orleans, which sits right on the Klamath River. It's a very rural, isolated, and just profoundly beautiful part of the state. I was there for what's called KTREX, or the Klamath River Prescribed Fire Training Exchange. That's an annual series of burns put on by a coalition, including the Karuk, area nonprofits and government agencies. So in a steep pine and hardwood forest above the town, you know, there were dozens of firefighters all strung out along a piece of hand line, and that was marking the intended edge of the burn. The burners, mostly Karuk women, they held a brief ceremony. And then, under the supervision of burn boss trainee Asia Conrad, herself Karuk, they started laying down strands of fire. And what you're hearing there, that's the burn slowly chewing through downed branches, leaf litter, and pine needles.
How big an area should I be imagining?
This has been described to me as one of the larger burns they've done to date, about 100 acres sitting right above. I mean, you could see the smoke from town and from the river.
Is the Karuk tribe's approach is it different from a prescribed burn managed by the state, for example?
Yeah, so in many ways, you probably wouldn't be able to tell them apart. So I did four seasons in wildfire, and what I saw were the same trucks, pumps, hand tools, fire-resistant Nomex-clad firefighters that I've seen countless times in the backcountry across the West. The pre-burn ceremony was an obvious distinction, but I think the key differences really come out in the underlying purposes of the burn, as well as the longer-term strategy that KTREX is a part of.
Well, what are the purposes? What are the benefits of burning?
Yeah, I mean, there are just so many reasons to burn. Prescribed fires can reduce fuel loading in forests, and that's one of the key legacies of decades of suppression-first wildfire policy. And that, in turn, can reduce the risk of extreme wildfire and, of course, the loss of life and property.
That means just sort of getting rid of the brush that's going to easily catch fire?
Absolutely. So just like imagine, we call them ladder fuels, smaller trees, shrubs, et cetera, that can help carry fire up into the crowns of fires and leading to quite destructive, fast-moving, extremely hot, hard-to-fight fires. So, you know, regular fire is just an absolutely essential underpinning of many ecosystems, and that very much includes the Karuk's ancestral territory. Prescribed fire can help remove invasive species, it can promote the growth of native species and add nutrients to the soil, improve wildlife habitat, but there are also some purposes of this burn and others like it. That's things like promoting the growth of hazel, which is essential to Karuk basketry, or helping black oak woodlands reestablish, and that's a critical source of food.
Murphy, what does the law say when it comes to burns like this?
So the one that I saw, I mean, prescribed fire trainings like this, they've been going on all over and for years. But in California, at least, the law around cultural burns conducted by indigenous fire practitioners, that's been shifting in recent years. Some are hopeful that the door could be opening to something that more closely resembles their longstanding traditions. For example, Senate Bill 310 was signed into law, and one of the key elements of that is that it allows the State Natural Resources Agency to enter into written agreements with federally recognized California tribes that would exempt them from state permitting and regulatory requirements for cultural burning. And shortly before the passage of that bill, Karuk Chairman Russell Atterbury called the measure, quote, an opportunity for California to walk the walk when it comes to healing and reconciliation of a violent history towards indigenous peoples and the misguided exclusion of fire.
So you mentioned you were in fire. Are you a former firefighter?
Yeah. So I did, God, at this point, well over a decade ago, I did a season on an engine and then did 3 seasons on a Type 1 hand crew based out of Southeast Idaho.
Did reporting this story change your perspective at all on fire management?
I mean, absolutely. And I really feel represented by what Karuna Greenberg told me. She's a non-native co-lead with the group that puts on K-Trex. So her family lost their home to a major wildfire in the area in the late 1980s. But in the wake of the devastation, native plants and animals surged back. And she described it as a rebirth.
When you start to pay attention, you can really recognize that fire is a life-giving force. And that switch in your mindset is really transformative.
So I think it's pretty clear and really has been for some time that we have a quite terrible relationship with wildfire. And I think the tragic LA fires only further highlight this reality. But the Karuk have a time immemorial tradition of living well with fire and actively using it on their land. And, you know, recent research found that something on the order of 7,000 annual ignitions burning some 15% of their territory every single year. That was what was common prior to colonization. And so for me, the Karuk compellingly show that a different relationship with fire is not only possible, but has a history in what we now call the United States, measured in centuries.
Thanks, Murphy.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
That's Murphy Woodhouse, reporter for Boise State Public Radio and the Mountain West News Bureau based in Boise, Idaho. The story was reported for Our Living Lands, a weekly program exploring climate change on tribal lands. Up next, we're going to continue this conversation and hear more about the Karuk tribe's relationship with fire from tribal member Bill Tripp, who is the director of natural resources and environmental policy for the Karuk. Bill is also an author on a recent study that estimates the scale of pre-colonial burning by the tribe. We'll talk about it. Bill, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Bill, tell me about the Karuk's history with fire.
Well, I mean, I'm one of those folks that, you know, was being taught how to burn early as 4 years old. And I was taught the fundamentals, both through our traditional stories, our oral traditions, as well as through being, you know, guided in practice at a very early age. We've been burning for thousands of years. And so we also have people in our community that have been passing this information down through their families. And so the principles are kind of established, you know what I mean?
Like what?
It's kind of hard to explain, really, but, you know, our stories speak about the responsibilities of the different animals and all the things that they did, and they give you some cues to key in on as you go through practice. And so, you know, by the time I was 8 years old, I was burning, you know, by myself. Adults were indoors, but I was out there by myself burning, and I knew if I had any trouble, I could go in and get some help, but I never did ever need any help.
Who taught you this practice?
Well, from the cultural aspect of it, that was my great-grandmother. I was a full-blooded Karuk. I was waiting for her to wake up one morning, and so I started, it was kind of cold, so I started to build a fire in the stove, and she heard me and came out and said, well, if you're going to be playing with fire, you're going to do something good with it. And she took me outside and gave me a, you know, a little test to see if I was able to, you know, observe my environment and my actions and adjust accordingly. And I passed her test. And so she started telling me the stories and started taking me out there whenever the time was right and just giving me the experience I needed.
When you were a little kid learning this, how much land were you burning? What did it look like?
I did a lot of my burning in February and March. And so I didn't, you know, get a whole lot burned. You know, I'd probably get a tenth of an acre to maybe an acre and a half, you know, burned in a day. But sometimes I could get, you know, that done every day for a 2 week period. And I focused right in close. You can go out underneath a pine tree after 2 or 3 days of sun, burn off a layer of pine needles. You can, around that same time, you can go out in the serpentine where the white thorn patches are, and there's just so much fine dead fuel in that. You know, you can burn those clumps off and break up the continuity of all of that fuel. And then, you know, a few days later, it's starting to dry out underneath the oaks, and then you can burn under those. And so you're it's a system to where you're creating a little bit of black over here. And then a few days later, you're able to burn into that black and use that as a control feature. Right. But you just have to do which component of the landscape is right in that day, in that time, in that moment.
And that's what you learn. And is it for land management only, like stewardship of the land, or are there other reasons?
Well, my great grandmother, she always said that about 80% of our, you know, traditional food, fiber, and medicinal resources are fire dependent. When she was young, and this was all done by more people more commonly, there was a lot more open space. There was a lot more spring greens and those kinds of things, a lot healthier foods, a lot more people with better materials for their basket weaving sticks, a lot more smaller dead wood that could be broken and carried back to the home for cooking and heating. And so our relationship with fire connects us to all of these things. Like live oak, for example, it's one of those things you go out in February and you burn underneath the oaks and live oaks, and you'll scorch off a lot of these younger live oak brush. You know, they have really pointy leaves, and that's a product of them being browsed. And so it's a protection from ungulates. It's a really favored browse for large ungulates. And so if you go out and burn those, they'll resprout. But if you don't go and you don't cut off those dead pieces that have all those dried pointy leaves, they can't get their nose in there to bite it. And so there's really intricate relationships there. It just so happens that time of year, we would use that for pushing eel, well, lamprey eel to the edge of the river. And so you go on your burn in February, March, and then April, May, June rolls around, and you have all this nice, freshly burned and dried and cured stuff with pointy leaves that then you can enhance your catch of your lamprey. Then that provides access for large ungulates as they're moving into their young, you know, being born and growing, and that's just a really high nutrient dense resource for them to browse on and have a really good start in life. And then we, you know, depend on, you know, deer meat, elk meat, and other things like that for our food later on in that cycle. But another interesting thing is by having that browse happen, it will force the stem to grow out and up. And so about 5 to 7 years later, that live oak branch will be long enough to be used for dip net hoops. And it'll be just perfect to where one small little piece can be tied to your A-frame holes that we use for fishing, and then it'll go out and up and around. And so you can tie the two together, and your net will hold open for like another foot wide. And so then you can then enhance your catch of salmon and steelhead. So it's all interconnected. So it's much more than just land management or fire protection, but it does also reduce the amount of fuel loading available during wildfire season.
I was just going to say, I mean, it's an integral part of a way of life, not just one tool to prevent, you know, uncontrolled wildfires, it sounds like.
Yeah. And people underestimate the scale of this activity, you know, being a way of life like that. It's, you know, it's when those time frames are, you know, upon you, that's what you go do. You know, it's hard to get everybody out there doing that these days. You know, you have to develop programs for it, or at least develop options where people can provide for their families, you know, in the conduct of doing such. And so we went through and looked at some of these cultural ignitions. You know, we ended up doing a little analysis of the scale in which that practice was historically done. And you know, we came up with a modest estimate of about 7,000 ignitions a year, you know, and not that large of an area.
So this was a study that you and your team published, looking at the impacts of burning on Crookland before colonization?
Yeah, and it was kind of a little bit of an attempt to get people to understand, you know, the scale of the need. You know, you figure, you know, 100 and some odd villages, each village just having a handful of people doing this, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a year for a couple solid weeks, it amounts to a lot of burning taking place all the time.
Warren, last question. I mean, of course, fires have been national news this month, last month. Watching these fires in LA, how did they strike you? Did you feel like there were lessons that you wish people would learn from crude practices that could be applied here?
Well, you know, I think people have a lot to learn. You know, I went and spent a little time down in LA here a year or so ago. And man, driving around in some of that country, it was just like, oh boy, people are gonna have a wake up call here eventually. When the conditions align with the weather event and that ignition, it's trouble. And it's not just LA, you know, I mean, you're seeing, you know, places like Santa Rosa burning in that way a couple times. You know, you've got communities all over the place that are, you know, burning down. You know, the Slater fire in 2020 took out 200 homes in Happy Camp in our Aboriginal territory. And, you know, all of that is, you know, trying to come back into, you know, an oak woodland type of condition, but which is the type of condition that we need to be able to do our cultural burning practices and have our cultural resources in place. But it's not going to get there on its own. It needs our help.
Bill Tripp is a member of the Kurukh tribe and its director of natural resources and environmental policy. He's based in Orleans, California. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Before we go, next Friday is Valentine's Day, and we want to hear from you. We are looking for your geekiest love stories. Maybe your meet cute bubbled up in the lab.
Yeah, maybe you dropped your beaker, and as you bent to pick it up, you locked eyes on the grad student across the table who beat you to it.
Or you found your life partner traipsing through leech-infested rainforests during a scientific field expedition.
Yeah, or stuck on a line of code in Starbucks and the latte next to you showed you a shortcut and you thought of how really smart your kids are gonna be.
Was it love at first science? Did you fall for someone across the fume hood or get butterflies over that bacterial culture? Call us and tell us about it.
Do we have a phone number we're going to give them?
Oh, yeah, maybe that would be a good idea. Okay, that number is 646-767-6532. Grab a pencil, 646-767-6532.
Or if you want to stay digital, send us a voice memo. That's a, you know, you'll record a little file and you'll upload that to scifry@sciencefriday.com. Lots of folks helped make this show happen this week, including
Praise Aguchi,
Sandy Roberts,
Robin Kasmer,
Jordan Smudgick,
Charles Bergquist.
BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of this program or you want to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts.
Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato.
And I'm Flora Lichtman.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. Later in the hour, an investigation into fraud and misconduct within Alzheimer's research. We'll talk with the author of a new book who makes the case that image doctoring might be part of the reason scientists haven't yet come up with an effective treatment for the disease. But first, last week, if you recall, we briefly talked about new advances in AI, especially this offering from a Chinese company called DeepSeek, which supposedly needs a lot less computing power to run than many of the other AI models on the market, and it costs lots less money to use. It's been described as so revolutionary that I really wanted to take a deeper dive into DeepSeek. What's all the buzz? What makes one model smarter than another, less power hungry? Joining me to help dive into that is Will Douglas Heaven, senior editor for AI coverage at MIT Technology Review. He's based in the UK. Welcome back to the program, Will.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me.
Happy to have you. Is it really as good as people are saying?
Yeah. The thing is, I think it's really, really good. I think the thing that has got people really shocked is that it is as good as the best that the US has made. We're at a stage now where, you know, the margins between the best new models are pretty slim. You know, is OpenAI's best better than Google's best? Is that better than Anthropic's best? Just the fact that a Chinese company has matched what the best US labs can do is itself a shocking thing. I don't think people thought that China had caught up so fast.
So what is its competitive advantage here? From what I've been reading, it seems that DeepSeek computer geeks figured out a much simpler way to program the less powerful, cheaper NVIDIA chips that the US government allowed to be exported to China, basically.
They've done a lot of interesting things. There's also a lot of things that aren't quite clear. So we don't know exactly what computer chips DeepSeek has. And it's also unclear how much of this work they did before the export controls kicked in. But from the several papers that they've released, and the very cool thing about them is that they are sharing all their information, which we're not seeing from the US companies. It looks like they have squeezed a lot more juice out of the NVIDIA chips they do have. They've got done some like very clever engineering work to sort of reprogram them down at very low levels to kind of, you know, get more power out of the box than NVIDIA gives you by default. So that's one cool thing they've done. These are also sort of got innovative techniques in how they gather data to train the models. But one key thing in their approach is they've sort of found ways to sidestep the use of human data labelers, which, you know, if you think about how you have to build one of these large language models, the first stage is you basically, you know, scrape as much information as you can from the internet and millions of books, etc. And, you know, we're probably familiar with that part of the story.
Stealing other people's data.
Yeah, pretty much. And as a side, as you know, you've got to laugh when OpenAI is upset. It's claiming now that DeepSeek maybe stole some of the output from its models. I mean, the schadenfreude is sweet. But all you get from training a large language model on the internet is a model that's really good at kind of like mimicking internet documents. It's not something that's very useful. The chatbots that we've sort of come to know, where you can ask them questions and make them do all sorts of different tasks, to make them do those things, you need to do this extra layer of training. And that's typically been done by getting a lot of people to come up with ideal question answer scenarios and training the model to sort of act more like that.
So you need a lot of people involved, is basically what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. That's time consuming and costly. DeepSeek's found a way to do without that. Probably the coolest trick that DeepSeek used is this thing called reinforcement learning, which essentially an AI model sort of learned by trial and error. Listeners might recall DeepMind back in 2016. They built this board game playing AI called AlphaGo. And so the amazing thing that they showed was if you get an AI to start just trying things at random, and then if it gets it slightly right, you nudge it more in that direction. If you do that many, 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 many times, then you end up incrementally getting better and better and better. So you ended up in DeepMind's case with an AI that could, starting from scratch, went on to beat a human grandmaster at Go. What DeepSeek has done is applied that technique to language models. You know, they didn't want it to play a game. Obviously, they wanted it to get better at giving thought through answers to questions that you asked the language model. And again, to start off with, it did a pretty poor job, but they nudged it bit by bit in the right direction. And you let that run enough times and it sort of figures out itself how to get better, sort of improving bit by bit as it goes.
So what you're basically saying is that it's teaching itself how to get better.
I hesitate sort of phrases like that because it always gives the AI some sense of agency and it's, you know, going to do its own thing. Yeah, there is a term called self-play. It sort of learns to play itself and get better as it goes. So you can think of it in that way.
You know, aside from the human involvement, one of the problems with AI, as we know, is that the computers use a tremendous amount of energy, even more than crypto mining, which is shockingly high. I mean, is DeepSeek less energy hungry then for all its advantages across the board?
Yet again, this is something that we've heard a lot about in the last week or so. And the answer to that as well is not as clear as it was initially made out. It does seem that they trained the model. They built the model using less energy and more cheaply. Running it may be cheaper as well. But the thing is, with the latest type of model that they've built, they're known as sort of chain of thought models. rather than if you're familiar with using something like ChatGPT, and you ask it a question and it pretty much gives the first response it comes up with back at you. But there's a brand new sort of paradigm in chatbots now where you ask it a question and it sort of takes its time and steps through, sort of, you know, shows its answers, shows its reasoning as it steps through its response. And each one of those steps is like a whole separate call to the language model. So although DeepSeek's new model, R1, may be more efficient, the fact that it is one of these sort of chain of thought reasoning models may end up using more energy than the vanilla type of language models we've actually seen. And another complicating factor is that now they've shown everybody how they did it and essentially given away the model for free, I think we can expect so many other companies and startups and research groups sort of picking it up and you know, rolling their own based on DeepSeek's technique.
One of the criticisms of AI is that sometimes it's going to make up the answers if it doesn't know it, right?
Right.
There are two layers here. One, how does it stack up on reliability or this issue, as they call it, hallucinations? And second, because it's a Chinese model, is there censorship going on here?
Yeah, so a lot of stuff happening there as well. All models hallucinate, and they will continue to do so as long as they're sort of built in this way. You know, they're statistical slot machines. You can polish them up as much as you like, but you're still going to have the chance that it'll make stuff up. And I've seen examples that DeepSeek's model actually isn't great in this respect. If it can't answer a question, it will still have a go at answering it and give you a bunch of nonsense. Anecdotally, based on, you know, a bunch of examples that people are posting online, having played right. around with it, it looks like it makes some howlers. But yeah, the question of censorship is interesting. I mean, I guess it's not surprising at all that a model built in China, it can't tell you anything about Tiananmen Square. It won't answer questions about Chinese politics at all. It just says, you know, I'm sorry, let's talk about something else.
If they're innovating like this, but making their code available, open source, as you say, are we likely to see the other competitors saying we're going to use this because why not?
Yeah. I mean, well, you can download the DeepSeek app from, you know, the App Store or Google Play and have a go with it right now.
For free?
For free. Yeah. I've been playing with it. I mean, I quite like it. In many ways, it's more friendly than ChatGPT or Google's Gemini. But there are also lots and lots of companies that sort of offer services that sort of provide a wrapper to all these different chatbots that are now on the market. And you go to those companies and you can pick and choose whichever one you want. Within days of it being released, you know, many of these companies were offering DeepSeek as one of the alternatives. Of course, not just companies offering, you know, DeepSeek's model as is to people, but because it's open source, you can adapt it. So there's a company called Hugging Face that sort of reverse engineered it and made their own version called OpenR1. There's also a technique called distillation where you can take a really powerful language model and sort of use it to teach a smaller, less powerful one, but give it most of the abilities that the better one has. And DeepSeek's R1 has already been distilled into a bunch of different models. Yeah, so I think we're going to see adaptations of it and people copying it for some time to come.
So what's your take on artificial general intelligence? We've talked about this before on the show. Will we be getting there and when, in your opinion?
I am super skeptical about everything about AGI.
You are.
Partly it's just a term that means very little. It means different things to different people who use it. I think it's become a marketing term more than anything else. I mean, I roll my eyes when people like Sam Altman tell us that AGI is coming. He was telling us that 2 or 3 years ago. And when I spoke to him then, you know, he'd say, you know, the reason OpenAI is releasing these models is to show people what's possible. Because society needs to know what's coming, and there's going to be such a big societal adjustment to this new technology that we all need to sort of educate ourselves and get prepared. Now he's talking about AGI still coming, but he means something, you know, I don't know, like a sort of a workplace productivity tool that we're all going to use. And that's now what he means. And I'm picking Sam Altman as the example here, but like most of the big tech CEOs all write blog posts talking about, you know, this is what they're building. I think AGI has been this term that essentially means, you know, AI, but better than what we have today. The definition that's most usually used is, you know, an AI that can match humans on a wide range of cognitive tasks, but how do you really test that? And how would you know when we've got there? And it's not clear at all that we'll get there on, you know, the current path, even with these large language models. Maybe they'll plateau soon. Maybe they'll just be very, very good language mimics and, you know, we'll stop there. And there'll have to be a whole nother breakthrough and a different type of AI technology to take us further. But the AGI is my least favorite term.
Well, Will, I want to thank you for taking us really into the weeds on this. I hope we still have a few listeners left who appreciate how deeply we've taken a dive here, but I really enjoyed it. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Will Douglas Heaven, Senior Editor for AI Coverage at MIT Technology Review. We have to take a break, and when we come back, an investigation into fraud and wrongdoing in Alzheimer's research. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. Every year, billions of dollars are funneled into Alzheimer's research. And yet, so far, there's no treatment that's been able to reverse the disease or even meaningfully slow the cognitive decline of patients. Part of the reason is that the disease is complex. Brain disorders are notoriously difficult to understand. But in a new book, an investigative science reporter makes the case that there's another reason Alzheimer's treatments have stalled, and that is scientific fraud. Charles Piller is an investigative journalist at Science Magazine and author of the new book, Doctored: Fraud, Arrogance, and Tragedy in the Quest to Cure Alzheimer's. He's based in Oakland, California. Charles, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me, Flora.
Your book starts with the story of the drug simufilam, which was in phase 3 clinical trials to treat Alzheimer's. Ultimately, it was found ineffective. But even before that, while it was still in trials, a neuroscientist whistleblower uncovered some red flags in the science underpinning the drug. Tell me about it.
Sure. So this drug was made by a company called Cassava Sciences. And the drug was haunted by concerns associated with a few different aspects of its development. First was the basic science behind its development as a compound that could possibly be an effective drug. And this testing, this scientific research, was found by a particular image sleuth, a guy by the name of Matthew Schrag at Vanderbilt University, to be riddled with suspect scientific images. And ultimately, there were lots of concerns that were raised about both the company and the drug, both clinically and in the basic science behind it. And some of these were stories that I broke in the pages of Science, including a finding of egregious misconduct by one of the key scientists behind the drug. Additionally, there was a admission by the company itself that it had cherry-picked data to make it look better in clinical trials than it actually looked. So that's a lot of problems, a lot of problems with this drug.
For this drug, was the FDA aware of this misconduct and the doctored images that Matthew Schrag found? And did they still let the trials go on, even though they had this awareness?
In a word, yes. The FDA was aware of every element of the concerns about the company, the concerns that even in one case, their own inspectors learned of and reported to the FDA chain of command.
Did you speak to anyone from the FDA? Did they have an explanation?
The FDA would not give any interviews to me on this, even though I requested many times. And in fact, by and large, they are pretty closed-mouthed about all these matters. And that's very problematic because it leaves the public wondering what's going on and why.
I want to talk about this whistleblower, Matthew Schrag. So he uncovered this apparent image doctoring in the case of this drug. But then he took it much further.
So basically what happened is that after that episode, he became increasingly interested in trying to learn whether this was more or less a one-off or if there was reason to be concerned that other important research in the field might be affected by apparent misconduct. And in the process, he ran across a study that was published in 2006 in the very important scholarly journal, Nature. And this study was a seminal study in the history of Alzheimer's research. And what Matthew Schrag found in looking at it stunned him. And I was actually on the phone with him just very shortly after he started to look at this. And the two of us were a little bit gobsmacked by it, because here you have a situation where one of the most influential studies in the last couple decades seemed to have been based on doctored images.
Doctored images, what should I be picturing? How are they doctored?
I think the way to think about these doctored images is two key examples that are very prevalent in Alzheimer's research. One is something called micrographs, which are highly magnified images of tissue, usually brain tissue in this case, could be animal or human brain tissue. And the other is something called Western blots. Western blots are a technique for displaying different proteins, and you can show both the amount of a particular protein and the types of proteins that are within a tissue sample. This is very important because proteins are thought to be key to understanding Alzheimer's disease. And so alterations can be made in each of these kinds of images. Things can be moved around, they can be copied and pasted, they can be erased to sort of suggest that an experiment was successful when there are reasons to doubt that it actually was proven.
So the image is actually the data. I mean, it's essentially falsifying the data.
Exactly right. And just to provide a little bit of context, as part of the research for my book, I worked with a number of forensic image analysts who are experts in trying to identify possibly doctored images. And we looked at 46 scientists in the field, many of them leading figures in Alzheimer's research, and found there were many hundreds of studies that appeared to be based on doctored images.
Many hundreds of studies.
Many hundreds, yes, that had been cited about 80,000 times in the scientific literature.
Okay, many hundreds of studies that have been cited 80,000 times had doctored images.
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's sobering, a degree of concern associated with apparent misconduct or error or both in the field.
Talk to us about the amyloid hypothesis. You know, what is it and how does it fit into this?
So let me go back, if I may, very briefly, more than 100 years to the way in which Alzheimer's disease was discovered and named by the German scientist Alzheimer, who was the guy behind all this. So he was a pathologist, meaning that he did autopsies, and also a clinician for people with dementia. And he had a patient who had very serious dementia. After she died, he did an autopsy of her brain. And what he found there were a couple of different kinds of classic Alzheimer's-related proteins. Now, one is amyloid beta plaques. These are the sticky plaques that people hear about related to Alzheimer's disease. And the amyloid hypothesis holds that the presence of these amyloid proteins leads to a series of biochemical changes in the brain that ultimately kills brain cells and causes dementia. So there was a lot of logic and a lot of really clear evidence to suggest that amyloid proteins were at the heart of this problem. But for decades and decades and decades, there wasn't that much money and that much time spent on research associated with the disease because of a simple demographic reason. Not enough people were living to late old age when Alzheimer's normally becomes a problem. And so consequently, as medical developments started extending our lifespans, suddenly the population of people experiencing Alzheimer's dramatically grew. And the government started to say, this is a big problem. We've got to spend a lot of money on it. And it was during that period, actually in the 80s and then early 90s, where this amyloid hypothesis developed and became the central focus of research for a very long time.
So a lot of fields have dominant hypotheses, right? What goes wrong, in your view, with the amyloid hypothesis?
What has gone wrong, in my view, is that there has been, I don't know, you could probably call it something like a scientific monoculture that developed around this hypothesis. And there's a way in which the domination of one set of ideas that are characterized by this amyloid hypothesis had taken hold in the field that tended to crowd out other ideas and kind of lead to a groupthink and a lack of creativity that was getting funded and well supported by the scientific community.
What I'm asking is, so there's this dominant hypothesis, and I totally understand how that might lead to people pursuing fewer alternate lines of research, right? Because the funding dollars are all going to flow to this dominant hypothesis. But how does that lead to misconduct?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't inherently lead to misconduct. By no means does it do that. But the way the amyloid hypothesis ties into this issue is as follows. When an idea is so dominant in the field, it creates incentives for people to go after that idea. And this is in terms of funding and to get credit for important work. If you move with the conventional wisdom, you often have greater success. But there's also another side to it, which is that if people are dishonest, it's clear that being dishonest or doctoring images in a way that fits in with the conventional wisdom makes it easier for them to get through the gatekeepers of science, the institutional authorities whose job it is to ensure that the science behind these studies is true and correct. If you're meeting their expectations with yet another permutation or finding associated with the amyloid hypothesis, then people are thinking to themselves, oh yes, of course, we expect this. It must be right. And that is the problem.
Confirmation bias.
Exactly right.
You know, of course, there's wrongdoing and cheating and fraud in every industry, as you say, you know, people are people. But I think what's so shocking about your book is that science is supposed to be self-correcting. Like there are mechanisms in place like independent peer review and replication of experiments and double-blind studies that are supposed to guard against all this. But it seems like they've failed in this case.
Well, I totally agree that science is self-correcting, but it may take a very, very long time. As Matthew Schrage said, you can't cheat to cure a disease. So in the long run, you know, science is going to grind on and people are going to figure this out. They're already figuring it out. And then new ideas will take their place.
You know, we're in a moment of high scientific skepticism. What do you make of people who point to this story and say, look, the scientific process is a fraud?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question, Flora. It's something that I ponder and think about all the time, in part because there are people who dishonestly try to point to these kinds of investigations and say it proves that all science is unreliable. This is nonsense. You know, even though this is a book that describes a lot of misconduct in the field, I would say that on the whole, the vast, vast majority of scientists who are doing this work are honest, well-intended, and do this research with great integrity. And I think the fundamental problem is that the scientific institutions that are charged with ensuring the integrity of the system, the funders like NIH, the regulators like FDA, universities, and the scholarly journals, many of them have been very complacent. They haven't taken the concerns associated with image doctoring and other forms of misconduct seriously enough. And as a result, their processes for detecting, correcting, and at times policing the scientific record have been inadequate. And so what I think my book is an opportunity for those institutions to take a good hard look in the mirror and say, what has gone wrong in our important areas of research that we need to address much more deliberately and with greater responsibility and with greater speed? If they do not, I'm afraid that anti-science forces, including some within the current administration in Washington, they will do the job themselves and it will not be pretty. So I'm asking the scientific institutions to think about it and to do better.
If you could wave your magic wand, how would you change scientific institutions?
People need to understand that the investigations of allegations of misconduct usually are managed by the home institution of the investigator. So if it's a professor at a university, it's that university that looks into the problem and tries to find out whether there's any truth to the claims of misconduct. That is probably the least efficient and worst way to do it, because that institution is very conflicted. They have the most to lose and the least to gain by doing a swift and penetrating and publicly accessible examination of the issues. So we need to have independent agencies that would handle those sorts of investigations. That's step one. Step two is that scholarly journals, which are the gatekeepers of scientific knowledge, they definitely need to up their game in examining and correcting doctored images that come through in papers that are submitted to them for publication. Step number three, I think, is that FDA and NIH need to be vetting candidates for jobs and drug development candidates for possibly doctored images in applications. They're not doing that well enough. And so what you have is drugs like the drug from Cassava Sciences that have suspect research behind it, that instead of being stopped in midstream to be reexamined, it just sails through the FDA approval process and then fails of its own weight. In the meantime, patients who were involved in those clinical trials were in effect being exploited for no good.
You've been reporting this story for years. From all of those conversations that you had, what's your takeaway on the root cause of these problems?
Sure. I think the root problem is, first of all, this is a disease that is so difficult to solve. The brain is so complex. There's so much we don't know about what might cause the disease and how it progresses. And consequently, there's an enormous amount of frustration in the field, more frustration, I would say, than in other diseases like heart disease or cancer, where there have been solutions found to many of the elements of those diseases. So one part is frustration, which leads to people cutting corners. But what I'm saying is that people who benefit from these studies that have been inappropriately altered have a responsibility to redouble their scrutiny of science. Science is a team sport. It's very difficult in today's very complex experimental world for one person to do one of these kind of experiments. And so it means checking, double checking, verifying information, and trying to validate that the findings really are what they seem.
Charles, thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure, Flora. Thanks for your interest.
Charles Piller is an investigative reporter at Science Magazine and author of the new book, Doctored: Fraud, Arrogance, and Tragedy in the Quest to Cure Alzheimer's. He's based in Oakland, California. If you want to read an excerpt of the book, go to sciencefriday.com/doctored. That's sciencefriday.com/doctored. We have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll talk with the creators of the new animated TV show Common Side Effects about how they created a thriller about a mushroom. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. In the new Adult Swim show Common Side Effects, an eccentric scientist has a secret. He's discovered a strange mushroom that can cure any illness or injury, and he wants to get it to the people in need. The only problem is that a pharmaceutical company doesn't want that secret to get out and will do anything to make sure he's stopped. The show is pioneering a brand new genre that I hope will dominate my algorithm, the mycological thriller.
This might look like individual fungi, but what you're seeing is a single intelligence.
The blue angel mushroom could have effects 100 times anything we've ever seen.
They want it nipped in the bud.
I'll call the DEA right now, whatever it takes.
Joining me now to talk about this fungal drama are the show's creators, Steve Healy and Joe Bennett. Steve was a writer for 30 Rock and Veep, and Joe is creator of the animated sci-fi show Scavenger's Reign on Max. Welcome to Science Friday.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so this story revolves around a magical mushroom. Are either of you fungi freaks?
We're both enthusiasts of mushrooms as insane phenomena. It's hard not to be interested in mushrooms, and they, the more you learn about them, the more interesting they become. Some of them will kill you. Some of them are delicious. Some of them make you feel funny. They communicate. There's so much we have to learn about them.
They're older than humans.
Older than plants and animals. Yes, I think it's fair to say we're pretty interested in mushrooms.
Yeah, you talk about them lovingly and you write about them lovingly. Let me play a quick clip.
A mushroom.
Not just any mushroom. The caviar, the ghost orchid of mushrooms. I mean, the chances of this growing naturally. Francis, it's like a 1 in 1 billion Goldilocks situation. A special valley, isolated by mountains. The fog lasts just long enough. The humidity is just right. The limestone in the soil is perfect to produce a rare, specific kind of grass. And in this grass grows a very, very intense mushroom. And I found it.
Did you base your mushroom off of a real mushroom? Like, was there some inspirational mushroom for you?
There is a mushroom in New Zealand. I forget the scientific name for it. That's like bright blue. But I had wrote a book about a journey I took through South America, and I tried some of the various plant medicines on offer down there, like ayahuasca and stuff like that. And Joe and I were talking about this, and we got to talking about a sort of thought experiment of, if there were a medicine that could cure almost anything, what would that look like and what would happen? And a mushroom felt right, because mushrooms are strange, and our human interactions with them are a little strange. They're kind of hard to grow. Humans have a long history of harvesting plants and fruits and nuts and stuff, but mushrooms are a little, they feel like they're difficult to contain. Mm-hmm. And that seemed exciting from a storytelling perspective.
The bad actor in your story is a pharmaceutical company. And of course, you know, right now there's tremendous pushback and discontent with the pharmaceutical industry. Why did you want to explore this?
Joe and I are interested in how interacting with the healthcare system is annoying.
Yeah, we all know.
Yeah. But on the other hand, it brings us all these wonderful things. I mean, people keep asking us, like, if Big Pharma is the enemy, but we're all grateful to Big Pharma for the wonderful products they've provided. But on the other hand, once you have systems that are profit-driven and motivated by things like stock price and shareholder value, warped incentives enter into the system. And our villains in the show aren't exactly, we don't intend for it to be like a particular evil person, but rather like the way the system kind of warps and changes and creates these twisted outcomes for people.
You know, on the same note, I think scientists can often be flattened in pop culture, like in TV and movies. This is a pet peeve of mine. Like, they end up just being like the jargony, dweeby,
right,
socially challenged man. And I didn't feel that way about your scientists, and I wondered if you thought about that, like breaking that stereotype at all.
Well, we were thinking about that. There are a whole bunch of characters who are kind of on the fringe of science, like people who are out there kind of pushing it, and sometimes what they're doing is not fully accepted right away, and it takes a while for it to enter into the mainstream, and they're often, they can seem a little strange, but as you mentioned earlier, they can be kind of charismatic and exciting.
Yeah, from that kind of fringe side, John LaRoche, from Adaptation.
Mm-hmm. Right, the movie based on The Orchid Thief.
Right. We kept going back to this guy. Like, he's such a, you know, he's a little dirty. He's a little unhinged. He's got dirt under his nails, but he's super confident. He's extremely smart. He would always just sort of represent himself in court. You know, he can kind of like find the loopholes and things and ways of getting around things.
And these characters are also funny, and they often have contradictions. Joe and I, we went to visit a great desert botanist out in the Mojave Desert. And, you know, this is a person who's very in touch with the natural world and knows how to raise all kinds of desert plants. And we went to see her, and she just had like a 32-ounce Carl's Jr. like Pepsi on her desk. And and both the blend of like, you know, the stuff that we eat and drink and the natural stuff and chemicals and all that mix up seemed exciting to us.
Joe, why animation for this show?
I came from a sort of independent animation background, and animation for me was just a means to tell a story. I've fallen more and more in love with the idea of 2D animation and things that are hand-drawn. It just feels like, especially this day and age, you know, it's nice to see, like, this is a scene that was crafted by a human person, and you know, people really like labored over this, and you kind of see it.
Joe, let's talk about your other show, Scavenger's Reign, a little bit. So this is an animated show about a group of people trying to survive after they crash on an alien world. And to me, it was sort of like Miyazaki meets David Attenborough, like nature documentary set in another world. Let's play a clip.
This place, nothing really makes sense. It's like a puzzle.
We just can't help the instinct to give meaning to things we don't understand.
Oh, God. I think there's something out there.
Joe, how are these two shows related in your mind?
I think a big part of it was just humans and their relationship with nature. You know, I grew up in the woods. My parents built a log cabin, and I was surrounded by 20 acres of woods. I had no neighbors. I guess, like, as a child, there were times where it felt a little insufferable, but kind of in hindsight, I feel like it really fostered my creativity. And also, I developed a profound respect for an interest in nature. And I think I would say that the main overlapping themes of these two things are our relationship with nature and the sort of certain fragility and I guess the repercussions on when it's being abused. And I guess thinking about sort of mycelium, the idea of mycelium as a neural network that's connecting all of these plants and organisms, you know, and I just got really inspired by all that. And even today, we're still uncovering all of this incredible stuff in nature. Just trees are able to talk to each other, you know, like that's just insane to think about. And that was like a more recent discovery. It's just wild.
Yeah, no. I mean, I love the creatures in Scavenger's Reign. Like, I just find them so engaging. And I wondered, what's your process for dreaming up, you know, animals or nature on another planet?
Well, it's funny that you asked that because me and my co-creator, Charles, we really had a difficult time trying to come up with something that doesn't already exist in nature on Earth. It was like, oh, it's almost all of it's already here and we're just not aware of it. So a lot of it was just sort of cherry picking from that. I mean, you say David Attenborough. I mean, I was watching nature docs nonstop and I was like, it's all there. There's so many mind-blowing symbiotic relationships that are just so inspiring and almost kind of like I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel here.
That came through. I mean, for nature lovers, it felt like there are all these kind of Easter eggs, you know, when you saw the aliens doing these behaviors that we know exist on Earth, like organisms enlisting other organisms to collect their food for them. So I really appreciated that about the show. Steve, on Veep and 30 Rock, you know, obviously you're exploring politics and the world of TV. Do you think there's like untilled ground for comedies that take place in a science context?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, there's a lot that's weird and paradoxical and strange about science and biology. And it's both funny and strange that we are walking around in these biological units that are confining and also exciting and we'll never quite understand. And we're all trying to master them with our brains, which are, of course, also part of the biology. So it's a mess when you start to think about it, and that makes for comedy.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, this is my secret hope, not secret because I'm telling you. I really want someone to make The Lab like an office style show.
Oh, yeah.
Set in the lab.
Let's collab off channel.
I'm here for it. Help me make this happen.
We try to live every day like it's Science Friday. So, yeah.
All right. Well, that seems like the perfect place to leave it. Thank you both for taking the time to chat.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Flora. It's a pleasure to be here.
Steve Healy and Joe Bennett are the creators of the series Common Side Effects, now airing on Adult Swim and streaming on Max. And if you want to learn about how real-life scientists are searching for hidden fungi, read the latest article from our newsletter, Science Goes to the Movies, at sciencefriday.com/side effects. Sci-fi producer Rasha Aridi is out in the cold doing some reporting for us. Rasha, give me the snow down. Where are you right now?
Yeah, I am right outside my apartment building. We just had a big snowstorm come through, and I'm standing in, like, 7 inches of like very fluffy snow, which is the most I've seen in like years. So it's a big day. And it also brings back a familiar scent, the smell of snow.
I'm not sure I know the smell of snow. Can you describe the smell of snow?
Okay. It smells clean and fresh and like a lot of nothingness. But part of it is also the feeling, like the air is so cold that my nose is tingling and the air in my lungs is really sharp. And so all together, it tells me there is snow, even if I would close my eyes. So I got to thinking, why does snow have a smell? It really is just water. So what is this that I'm sniffing?
Surely someone knows what snow smell is made of. And maybe you should go somewhere warmer for this part.
Yeah, don't have to tell me twice.
I like snow, and I've experienced snow a lot in my life.
Dr. Johan Lundstrom isn't just a snow aficionado, but an olfactory expert. He's trying to untangle how smell works at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm.
Born and raised also in northern Sweden, where we are quite familiar with snow, and we have it from basically September to April.
So, Flora, here's the first thing you need to know. Snow itself is porous and spongy, so it's really good at grabbing on to odors and trapping them. So when you smell snow, you're mainly smelling what it kind of sponged up.
Let's say you're scooping up the snow from a bundle of roses. The chemical that you're smelling is going to be an alcohol. It's called phenyl alcohol, which basically are in plants and roses.
My snow never smells like roses.
Yeah, me too. I'm in a city, so I'm, you know, picking up notes of pollution, fumes from cars, asphalt, stuff like that. So unfortunately, not roses. Okay, so the next thing you need to know is that when you sniff snow,
it's actually physical objects that you are smelling. So those physical objects, very, very small chemicals, are traveling up to your nose.
And those chemicals bind to odor receptors, and that info gets sent to your brain. Then those molecules can get absorbed into your body. So, Flora, chew on that next time you're in a stinky public bathroom.
Absolutely not. I will not chew on that. Okay, here's a question for you, Rasha. Why weren't you picking up car exhaust in your snow bouquet?
Yeah, so the snow holds on to those odors, but the air itself has been kind of cleaned up by the snow, kind of like a natural air purifier. In fact, the air will probably smell the cleanest a few hours into a snowfall once it's kind of scrubbed the air. And because snow holds on to odors, it'll probably smell worse after it's been piling up on the ground for a few days versus if it's falling fresh.
That adds up to me.
Yes. So the other thing that we need to take into consideration is that even though there are odors in the snow for us to sniff, whether or not we actually pick up those scents is another question. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is the air itself. When the temperature drops, so does humidity, and the odors end up kind of moving in slow-mo, so they're less likely to waft up into our noses.
Oh my gosh, is that why a pile of garbage is so much stinkier in summer than it is in the winter?
Yes, exactly. Things are stinkier in the heat, including us.
Speak for yourself, Rasha.
Fair enough. And another reason we might not be picking up the subtleties of the snow bouquet is that our noses just don't work as well in the cold. Like, we're snottier, for example, which gets in the way of smelling.
Rasha, is the smell of snow related in any way to petrichor? You know, that smell after it rains?
Yeah, so some scents might be similar. Like, you might pick up that earthy, musty smell of a chemical called geosmin. It's found in soil and water. So if it rained right before it snowed, or if snow is, like, sitting on a pile of fresh soil, it might pick up that scent. And our noses are actually really good at sensing geosmin. Like, if you poured a teaspoon of that chemical into, like, 200 Olympic-sized swimming pools, you'd still be able to smell it.
Wow.
Okay, so the last thing you need to know about the snowy smell doesn't have as much to do with our noses as much as it has to do with our memory.
Only those odors that have some kind of meaning to us, particularly if they have an emotional meaning, tend to be remembered.
Smells that are most distinct to you tend to be associated with happy memories. Yuan says it might have to do with how our brains are wired. So the part of our brain that processes smells sends that information straight to our limbic system, which includes parts of the brain like the hippocampus and amygdala, which are key in regulating emotions and memory. Other senses take quite literally a longer route to get to the limbic system, but smell has a shortcut.
These intimate, unfiltered connection between the sense of smell and the memory acids of the brain are helping us to really encode and remember odors for a very long time. So every time I smell snow that has a very wet character, I'm taken back to our cabin up north, just around the Arctic Circle. If we go there in the spring sometimes and the lake starts to open up, then you have this very strong wet snow smell, which is, for me, is a very pleasant experience.
Rasha, do you have memories that you think make your brain sensitive to the scent of snow?
Yeah, I think so. Every time I smell snow, it takes me right back to being like a little kid, having snowball fights with my little brother, Nibal, and sitting in front of the TV, like hoping that school would be canceled the next day. So yeah, really happy times.
Maybe that's why it's so distinctive to you.
Yeah, I think so.
Rasha, I wish you many more trips down Smemory Lane.
Oh, thank you, Flora. Same to you.
Thanks, Rasha. And that's it for today's show. You can find us all week long on our podcast. Search for Science Friday wherever you get your pods, and we will see you next week. I'm Flora Lichtman.